ladies and gentlemen, standing here in Crown Hall with its scale that appealed so to Mies, I like to remember the first time I saw Mies van der Rohe and the impressions I had. It was in the spring of 1933. I had admired an apartment interior he had designed for Philip Johnson, who had recently settled in New York. I was on my way to Europe and Germany on a business trip. Philip suggested that I call on Mies. I wrote him. He invited me to his office. When my wife and I entered, we both saw at once the answer to a question which had been troubling us for some time. Why was the Barcelona seat so wide? As we opened the door, we realized Mies was seated on one, and it was just comfortably accommodated to his breadth. Perhaps amply would be a more accurate word than comfortably, for we recognized something ample about Mies himself at that first glimpse, a quality which seemed related to everything about him, everything he admired, everything he did. The suit he was wearing was ample, well cut to be sure, but easy on him, and of a sober, rich material. The cigars he offered me and smoked one after another were likewise ample and of the finest Havana leaf. The glass and chromium steel table near which he was seated, which we had always previously thought strangely high in proportion to its width, now looked perfectly in scale with its designer. Even on that first visit, I realized Mies's love of space, scale, and quality of material. And 33 years later, I was reminded of that first sight of Mies when one evening, after museum hours, looking for him, I happened into his Cullinan Hall of the Museum of Fine Arts in Houston and found him alone in that sparsely hung white gallery, 100 feet by 90 feet with a 32-foot ceiling height. Once again on a Barcelona seat, again smoking a similar cigar, quietly studying that space he had so sensitively proportioned. Another incident I like to remember was a telephone call I made to Mies in his apartment on East Pearson Street before rushing off to a plane. I had been in Chicago for the day for a lecture and was on my way back to New York. In my apologies for not having reached Mies earlier, I mentioned something of the general subject of my talk, order and form in contemporary painting. "Ah, yes," he said slowly, "St. Augustine, nothing more." Again, I recall one Saturday afternoon in New York, happening to drop in at the Nierendorf Gallery. An exhibition was scheduled to be on view. To my surprise, I found the gallery dismantled, or rather, in the process of being dismantled. Mies was in town, and frequently he and his friend Carl Nierendorf used to take advantage of the weekend to clear the gallery of what was on view and amuse themselves in arranging a special exhibition of whatever they liked particularly or wanted to see together from Nierendorf's stock. It might be a large selection of Nierendorf's best Paul Klees, of his De Brucke pictures, or a single painting on a large, otherwise empty wall, which, as a way of presentation, so appealed to Mies. Mies enjoyed this. He found it one of the happiest ways to spend a quiet weekend in New York. He loved Clay's paintings, as he had liked Clay personally. He knew perhaps better than anyone else how to choose a Clay painting of quality. And it was from Nierendorf's stock that he built up the excellent group of Clays he had in his East Pearson Street apartment. Clays, Schwitters, and what was always a surprise, a large Beckman nude in his bedroom. One is only to think of Mies's handsome 1942 drawings and collage designs for an ideal museum for a small city to realize how much he enjoyed paintings and sculpture and his respect for them. In these projects, one is hardly aware of the architecture. Where the presentation of works of art was concerned, he felt that they should have complete priority. Architectural details, fantasies in installation or lighting that might even slightly distract the observer's attention from the works of art were inadmissible. The only features he permitted major demands were open space and a sensibility to its division. The relative absence of architecture, as he put it, intensifies the individuality of each work of art and at the same time incorporates it into the entire design. I remember his escape to New York 10 days before his Cullen and Hall in Houston was inaugurated. Distressed by the preparations for the first exhibition to be held there, which he saw crowding the easy space he had envisaged for that hall. And I recall his request for photographs of an installation of the same gallery some time later, when only the three large paintings by Juan Miro were hung, with a large Picasso oil and a monumental Chillida sculpture. He wanted to send it to Berlin with his project for the Berlin National Gallery, and he did so. Space, amplitude, and a comfortable relationship among the parts, unity, order, form, were his basic requirements. A lack of order in any part hurt him. It's characteristic of the depth, complexity, and subtlety of Mies's view of architecture that the man whose Epicurean taste would wish to combine Roman travertine, Tinian marble, gray transparent glass, onyx and chromium-plated steel columns in his Barcelona pavilion, and walls of striped black and pale brown Macassar ebony and tawny gold and white onyx in his Tugendhat house, could also declare with warmth and sincerity, where can we find greater structural clarity than in the wooden buildings of old? Where can we find such unity of material, construction, and form? What feeling for material and what power of expression there is in those buildings? What warmth and beauty they have. They seem to be echoes of old songs. This from Mies. Whom we associate with the statement that concrete, steel, and glass are the materials of our time, And from these materials, the forms of our epoch should evolve. But for Mies, everything depended on how we use a material, not on the material itself. Each material, as he said, is only what we make it. And Mies, no matter what material he employed, as the bequest of buildings he has left Chicago bears witness, was essentially a builder. He never forgot his early lessons from his master mason father. I learned about stone from him, and I recall how pleased Mies was to recount the fact that as a young man, barely more than a boy, he had qualified as a journeyman bricklayer. "Now a brick," he would say, "that's really something." How sensible is this small, handy shape, so useful for every purpose? What logic in its bonding, pattern, and texture? What richness in the simplest wall surface? But what discipline this material imposes. On this homely basis, Mies established an unparalleled expression of new materials and engineering techniques, a form for an epoch. Discipline, order, form. This is the progress he saw underlying the statement from St. Augustine he was so fond of quoting. This, for him, in architecture, was truth. Beauty was its splendor. All education, he felt, must begin with the practical side of life. But true education is concerned not only with practical goals, but also with values. By our practical aims, we are bound to the specific structure of our epoch. Our values, on the other hand, are rooted in the spiritual nature of men. Our practical aims measure only our material progress. The values we profess reveal the level of our culture, the long path from the material through function to creative work has only a single goal: to create order out of the desperate confusion of our time. And this is the bequest which Mies has left to all of us, and particularly to Chicago: his vital, personal, and inspiring patterns of order in a world which has suffered too long in recent years the disregard of such a spiritual discipline. Today, there is no need to stress the value of Mies' contribution, nor his stature as an artist. As the latter, he had the good fortune to live, to realize the recognition that was universally paid him. To the world, he was a great architect and a modest, self-effacing man. To his intimates, he will always remain what he always was to them: a benign monolith, a warm friend, and a full human being.
Thank you. Test, 1, 2, up, up, hold, test, 1, 2, test, 1, 2,
Ladies and gentlemen, unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, I can hear a tremendous echo back here. It's awful. Where I am, it's awful. Da 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 da. Flat singing won't help. Dum bum bum, but that's better. What happened? I'm not getting that so much echo. Hello, 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 hello? I'm still getting an echo. Hello? How does it sound back there? How does it sound back there? How does that sound? Hello? Hello, how does that sound? Charles? No good? Okay, 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 I'll keep on talking. There, 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 that's very good. Oh, feedback. Hello, 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 I'm keeping talking, but nothing much is happening. What would you like me to do? Shut up? Okay.
What I'm going to do
do, do. Charles? Ladies and gentlemen, unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, there's something wrong. There's still a kind of... Do you get an echo? Oh, ho. I don't imagine anybody could hear anywhere. Okay, nothing's... Is it? No. Hello, hello? Testing, testing, testing. Is it supposed to sound like this? Doesn't sound very good from back here. You think so? Well, why don't you try it here? Let me see how I think it sounds over there.
Testing 1, 2, 3. That's bad to do. Pardon? Yeah. How's it sound back there, Bruce? Yeah. Pardon? Check and see if the plug on the other side is bad. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Is there a fader on the back of the speaker, Bruce? Testing 1, 2, 3. Well, then we've got a lousy speaker, that's all. That could be too. Yeah, yeah. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing. We've got a lot of echo up here. Hey, Bruce, how about aiming those speakers towards the front and see what that happens? Towards me. Testing 1, 2, 3. That gets rid of a little bit of the echo, mainly because it's not bouncing off glass infinitely. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Okay. What are you doing? Oh. Yeah. 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 Well, we get two guys and they stand back there, see, and that's it. Break the speaker. Yeah. Yeah. See what happens if you hit the ceiling. Yeah. It drowns it out. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, like putting two tables on top of one another. Yeah. That sounds like a very good idea.
There's
The unfortunate part about it is that the divider is not wide enough to support that speaker. I'd hate to have that thing fall down on top of somebody's head. That looks good, Bruce. That really does look good. Unfortunately, yeah. You know something, though? Unfortunately, it's going to sound great over there, you know? Like it's going to sound fantastic over there. Yeah, it should be traveling over. Hey, the echo left.
Boy, it's like nothing.
Yeah? Like nothing, huh? Bruce? Well, he's got the other speaker up. Put the speaker back up there and see if we can shoot over the barrier here. That's it. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. Nothing. My goodness. See, it's great for in here now, you know. But the people on the other side of the dividers are going to be in the dark because they can't hear. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see what you mean. Yeah. I mean, you're going to use these things here to split the sound. Oh, okay. Yeah. People in the front row can hear me. The speaker can hear himself. The problem we're running into is that the people on the side cannot hear now. In the front row? Is it? Yeah, I know. Echo-wise, is that the... See... Yeah. They're thinking of moving it back to the front of this divider. But then we're going to lose gain. See, because we'd have to keep the gain down. Because otherwise you'd induce feedback because the speaker and the microphone are closer together.
Can we try back to this for a second?
Yeah, anything you want. Yeah.
What were you saying about gain?
See, this microphone will be physically closer to the speaker.
Yeah.
Hence, we have to cut the gain down. Otherwise, we'll get feedback. See, so we'll be operating at a lower gain. And I don't know if we're going to get to the people in the back if we put the speakers up here. That's the only problem. So. But we'll cover a wine. What happened? Oh. They probably faced the speaker towards me. Yeah. This is a hard place to do sound. Pardon? Hold it.